I really don't want to be in the U.S. right now. So yeah, because yeah, the rest of the world,
I don't think anyone should come here.
The rest of the world is kind of watching it and is like, what the fuck is happening? I mean, are you like legit afraid of things that's happening? Because the lockdown is still on, right, over there, or not really?
Yeah, technically, the lockdown is still on. I mean, I was talking to my mom earlier today, and she's saying like a lot of this is a result of her generation seeing a lot of the problems that we have, but just ignoring them. So like, you know, racism has been around forever. Like police brutality has been an issue that I have been largely sheltered from. Like, but, you know, people have a right to be really mad about, and the economy, like, I mean, because nobody's working, like a lot of people just, and we don't, and like some people don't have health care. So it's like, we're seeing like the worst part of capitalism, yeah, kind of like exactly what Marx predicted would happen is sort of happening right now. And I just, it is kind of haunting to go to these protests and to see like the National Guard there and like the military there. And I don't know.
Bring in the tanks.
Yeah, I'm not a political analyst at all, but like,
yeah,
there's definitely a lot of tension,
especially when the president is like boiling, is actually censored by Twitter, which is like something that I would have totally expected that from a president from a third world country that's actually president for 20 years, you know. I actually asked myself this very question just a week before he was censored by Twitter. I was thinking, oh, one day probably like the Iranian president will say something again on Israel and full of hate or something, and then Twitter will have to censor them. And I was like, oh, that's funny how a corporation can censor a sovereign president, and it happened for the first time for Trump.
Yeah,
which is weird.
Oh god,
that is really ironic. How crazy, though. How crazy, you know, like United States, land of the free, freedom of speech, and who is the first person that you're gonna censure? It's the fucking president. It's a conflictual situation where you're sitting there like, oh wow.
It's really strange to...
Could you tell us about, like, how it's been... Have you gone out in Los Angeles, or did you just stay home, which is understandable considering how violent some of these protests, you know, turned out to be due to police intervention? But, like, could you give us, like, some feedback, like, live-action feedback as to how it was, how it went down?
I've been to a couple of protests. One of them was pretty laid-back. I mean, as laid-back as it can be, where, like, you know, it's still kind of a violent image to see like tons of police and see the National Guard and then see like these protesters who are mostly like really young and unarmed. And but I went downtown the other day I just needed to pick something up, like just in my life, like my day-to-day life. And downtown Los Angeles is already kind of like, even before all of this, before coronavirus, before the protests, you know, if you go to downtown LA, you're going to see a lot of homeless people, a lot of people on drugs. Like it's.
So I've heard, yeah.
So like there's still that happening, but then there's that plus like protesters, plus like guys with like huge guns.
Yeah.
And like the store that I had to go to had been broken into, and like the windows were shattered, and there's like trash.
What a good day! What a good day! Free meal. Sure. There you go.
So you're actually living in the beginning of a zombie movie. You're living it.
I really hope not. Like I hope that this is not the beginning of like an apocalyptic movie, but beginning it feels that way right now. Yeah.
But
it does feel a little bit like that.
The thing is, I've always said that, you know, humanity can, we always move forward when there's trauma, when there's something traumatic that happens. And I could definitely see things getting back to normal, even like a little bit worse just after the pandemic. The thing is here in France, already like corporations were talking about, you know, we might have to work on some days off, you know, to compensate for the economy, blah, blah, blah. And so already I kind of saw the Jeff Bezos kind of mentality seeping in to everything and thinking, well, all this for nothing. And then something else happened. And we needed that to be tired of things completely and to get, you know what, we might take a pandemic and knowing our hospitals are not furnished enough, etc., but we cannot take this plus systemic racism plus blah blah blah. But we just one at a time.
I agree with you, and I like that mentality actually, because there's a certain kind of optimism to that mentality where it's like, where there's the hope that things will get better because they need to, is like a really, it's like what I want to think right now.
How did you guys experience the lockdown? By the way, sorry, we're 20 minutes in, and I just want to say that this is an absolute honor. Finally, you've come to your senses. The rest can't invited me. God damn it. I had Charlie and Carter before me. I'm like, how dare you? You met them after me. What? How bad was I a friend? Like, what did I ever do to you, man? All right, so let's talk about this lockdown. How are you guys experience, or how did you guys experience it?
Yeah, why don't you guys tell me how it's been for you guys in your respective countries? I know that it was like really strict in Italy, but I don't, and France, like it was a little bit stricter than it is here.
Well,
but
in France, I just remember it kind of went really fast. Literally, like on Saturday, I was recording this podcast with two other stand-up comedian friends from the English scene, Alex Killian and Luke Charles. You might have seen them on stage, you two. And we were at my place, and we were still kind of speculating on what would happen with coronavirus, etc. And then on Monday, they told us, everything will be closed from now on. So it went pretty fast, pretty quickly. But staying at home, for me personally, I loved it.
Are you an introvert?
Thank you. Same.
Opinion. Let's not kid ourselves. I wasn't really going out a lot except for stand-up. So I was like, okay. I mean, obviously, 2 months in, you want to go out and you want to, you know, get shit-faced in a pub or whatever. But but to tell you the truth, I really liked the fact that no one expected anything from me during this period. And psychologically speaking, I really needed that to just be free, you know. So
preach.
Dude,
I caught up on so much reading, bro. I caught up on so many movies, so many shows. I was on my A game, man. Oddly enough, I'm more sports now than when I was, you know, I had other shit to take care of. I don't know, man. I just really had a blast. Had a really,
that's
really
great.
Good. What about you?
It was okay. I mean, I had a lot of introspection and a lot of like philosophical growth, I think, within myself. And I got some writing done, and I kind of had some perspective on like my biggest goals and dreams for myself, and like how that applies to other people and like in the greater world. And I really want to have like an international career with like a broad perspective on things.
That's interesting, but, because I kind of experienced that, the, you know, putting perspective on what you want to do, actually, just because you're not caught up in the machine, you know, of just doing things you were just accustomed to do. And now you could have just a little pause of saying, okay, does this, like the Marie Kondo of your own life, like, is this activity brings me joy? Does this activity bring me joy or not? And just have the time to actually say, okay, I'm not doing it, and I'm actually better. So you know what? Let's not do that anymore. and perhaps refine your objective. So now you know you want to have an international career. You want to be a superstar, basically.
I love how you started off with, I want to have an international career, brother. I just want to get a national career first.
I
Even
mean,
regional would
I
be.
don't know.
Yeah, regional is already great. Like I've come to my senses. It was all philosophical, a lot of, and at the end of it, after 2 months of deep thinking, I want to be a wealthy multi-billionaire. I want to have two corporations and be an international superstar. I mean, come on,
And
guys.
yeah, and the answer is just like he's putting out a map and he's like, I want to be like famous in Coventry and perhaps the suburbs of Coventry.
Exactly. Dude, I'm sitting here like I'm about to post my Indiegogo. I just want to make a short film. 1,000 pounds budget. One location, two actors.
That's not even what I meant. Like, I just meant like I want to stay connected to people in a like deep, meaningful way. But I like what you guys are saying too. Like, that sounds great. Like, I'm being an international superstar sounds
No, yeah, dream big. Don't have a shame of your dreams,
Of course.
But yeah, I do understand the thing about doing things internationally. I think it keeps you a little bit of on your toes and it keeps you relevant of on things that happen. That's why I like doing stand-up in English too and in French. But I would love if obviously I could perform more in foreign countries, because I'd be more I guess tuned to the humor in general and the humanity perhaps in general. But you've worked with different like directors as an actress and different nation citizenships with the directors, different countries. Do can you like see a little bit of cultural things on how they direct, can you see, can you say that, French directors are kind of like that, even though obviously people totally vary, but
Oh yeah, I mean, I would say it just varies so much from person to person. But I don't know. It's hard to make a. I guess when I think of like French style, it's maybe a little, or French directing style, it's maybe a little bit more kind of cheeky, or like it's a stereotype, but kind of like a little cheeky or a little bit like romantical or something.
Yeah,
Like
the artists.
I feel like Americans are kind of like, oh, like everything's happening. Like, I don't know. Like, I feel like
Really?
Americans are really like, I mean, they can be really direct when they need to be, but like, that's been my experience with like, not all of the American directors, but like, I feel like they're a little bit more like on high stress all the
Oh,
time somehow.
okay.
That's interesting because I have the impression that it's the opposite. Having worked with French, I feel like the French, I was like, oh, no, everything must be so perfect. Please, please, please smoke us. I must smoke a cigarette. I cannot. You've messed it up in take one. You messed it up in take one. Oh my goodness, why did I take you? I should have auditioned at the Conservatoire de Tours. Whereas in Americans, they're much more like, dude, yeah, man, roll of the tape, it's digital. We ain't got no stress. The tape ain't gonna lie, the roll isn't gonna stop after 10 minutes. Just go for it, They're so laid back from my experience, and
Interesting.
I have very little, but I've worked with two French film director, French directors and one American director. And yeah, the American was just so laid back. I don't know. That was the impression that I had. But I think that the reason why, I guess from your experience, like, were there any budgets in these projects? Because I don't even know, like, I didn't know that you'd work with so many directors. And what were like, were there budgets or no?
Yeah, I mean, I guess like in terms of feature film and being on sets, like I've done anything from like a $20,000 budget to like a multi-million-dollar budget. But that
Oh, wow.
was, in the multi-million-dollar films, I had a very, very small role. Like I appeared and like said hello, like, but you could still get a sense of like what the set is like and what the director works like. And yeah, I mean, it changes that in some ways too. I think I've met directors who can do a lot with a very little, and they get like really talented, like kind of stars involved. And then I've seen people who kind of just, they spend like 20 grand in a day, and it's like, what happened? Like, there's no footage. Like, what's going, you know? So I think it depends. It really depends on the person too.
And with the American directors, were those the productions that had multi-million dollar budgets?
That was actually in France. I worked on a set with Luc Besson.
Okay.
I did another film directed by Eva Ionesco.
Okay.
But that was, I think, barely a million. I don't know the exact budget for that, actually.
Yeah, but in France, you know, a million is a... You can do a lot of things.
Dude, a million is... Like, that's Avengers. That's Avengers.
Yeah. That's the French Avengers, yeah. Yeah, I love the disparity for the budget. You know, I remember, like, this interview that Mathieu Kassovitz gave to I don't know, an American thing. And because I think it was Joel Silver who watched the Les Rivières Pourpres, which is a Mathieu Kassovitz movie. And he was like, oh, that's a great action movie. What was the budget? Like 20, 20 30? And he was like, are you kidding? He was like 2.5 million, you know, euros. And obviously, like, the fact that we can do a lot of things on screen for less money, obviously, just kind of attracts some U.S. Production for this, man.
Definitely,
absolutely, man.
But I don't know.
Cheaper budget and cheaper, like, you know, cheaper pay since they're not as famous. Cheaper budget, and they're thinking we can get just as much for nothing. Yeah. So, right, let's hire them. And they often end in a fiasco. I mean, you want to talk about Babylon AD.
Yeah, obviously. But, you know, there's a lot to say for that movie. But that's the thing. Also, here for the... I have a friend who's a movie producer. She actually put up, like, a auteur movie for 80,000 euros, which is nothing, basically, but she managed to do it, and it was exploited in movie theaters, etc. So that's awesome.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and
that's incredible.
That's also the thing is, when you're kind of outside the industry, you can you're not in the... you actually ask yourself the question on what do you need really to do things. And the level also of technology now makes you ask yourself the question. I mean, there's a lot of things you can do pretty much by yourself. I mean, you should know that, yes, because you probably, like, shorts or whatever, you did probably like four jobs on the regular thing, right?
Yeah, writer, producer. You find yourself in these because, you know, it costs too much money. So writer, producer, director, that's what's so beautiful about short films. They're really your best film school. I had like a geeky question as an actor, right? Because I'm just learning, like, I didn't know that there was a whole language to directing actors before coming to film school. For me, it was really, it's all in the page. That's it. Just read it out loud. I don't understand. You're an actor. You should understand the intention. But then you go to film school and it's this whole thing in Judith Weston. And so there's a thing called result directing. For the one or two people listening, result directing is basically when a director just doesn't discuss, like, the want and need of a character. He just goes over and says, I want you to cry here, and then on this particular line, I need you to laugh, and then on this particular line, you need to be scared, and then on this particular line, just go back, and then it becomes like super robotic, and like the actor doesn't really get to feel and, you know, embody whatever, like, the character and really feel the words, because you're mapping out every single one of his reactions. So for me, it's, how often did you get result directing? Because, you know, in film schools, they tell you it's the bad way to do it. And then when you hear professionals, they still say, oh, yeah, the majority is still result direct, because they don't take the time to really understand our craft. So that's my question. It's a long question. I'm sorry.
No, I think that's really interesting. Like, I have an acting coach, actually. He's 95 years old, and he's all about, like, he loves actors. He's he's really,
he's all about silent movies, so Sophia doesn't talk.
Yeah. But
you know, he's like, shh.
Yeah, he's like, just don't talk. But he's like, but he said the exact same thing, where there are a lot of directors out there who just want you to cry. Oh, yeah. So you have to learn how to do that for yourself. But I've had it, I don't know, like I've had it both ways. I guess I haven't had like a large enough role in a movie yet to really, I am now for the first time, I'm working really hands-on with a director, but his style is very alternative and he's very experimental.
What does that mean? Sorry. What does that mean? How do you direct alternatively other than saying action and cut?
So basically we're going to be shooting this film in like November, December, but we've been meeting once a week for the past like 3 weeks to talk about like all of my psychology, basically.
Okay.
Because he really wants to like build the character around like who I, like what I have inside of me, which is cool for me. Like, I think, you know, it's an experiment, it's a small budget, like queer art film, but I think it's really cool to have that really intense intimacy with a director. And I that's like, I think pretty rare to have like that level of like time commitment with somebody. But he believes in like stripping, he doesn't believe in like putting skills on an actor. He believes in like stripping down like all the false like things that you put on yourself in society. So
basically you're doing a job and also getting a free psychotherapy.
That's
exactly it, brother.
Now,
but like, what kind of direction do you like? Is that the kind that you like? Because I've actually surprisingly, so I've met two kinds of actors in this film school. The first who don't like any result direction. Like, I remember I gave him my script, and so I naively put the reactions that I'd like my actors to say, you know, just under the title. Okay. So like name, I don't know, John, scared, and then the line. The dude came up. Yeah, the parentheses.
Les didascalies, how we say in
exactly,
les
didascalies. Yeah. Exactly. Right. Exactly.
He just freaked out. He just didn't want them.
He freaked out. He took a pen and he just, let me teach you something, Yasser. And I go, yeah, what's up? And he goes,
okay. That's the,
don't ever tell your actor how to feel.
That's the Chris.
Don't ever tell him
that's
that.
That's the Christopher Walken way. I hear he hates that, and he's like, no. Just put on the dialogues, and that's it. I mean, if I know what the scene is about, fuck off, you know. Which means that actually the guy has to know what the scene is about, and he has to be also kind of implicated in the, you know, in the whole process of the movie, which I mean, you kind of have to have also a good actor. A good actor does that, perhaps. No, I would think. Sure. I mean, not a good actor in just only in skills, but also like in the fact that he wants to help the movie get made.
Yeah, professionalism. Yes. Yeah. I think I'm like at a point where I'm just like, I'm going to accept whatever somebody is going to kind of throw at me. Especially because I feel like I'm, you know, I'm trying to do a lot of different things and I feel like I'm in the early stages of my career. So I'm kind of like, like whatever you like.
Just give me anything, bro. Just
I want to be accommodating and I'm in a learning process, but there's definitely, I mean, I don't want someone to be a dick. Like there's a lot of creeps, like the stereotype that there's a lot of creeps in Hollywood is absolutely true, unfortunately.
Really?
And, no. Yep. I've had like 3 Me Too experiences in the past like 6 months.
Really?
Yeah. It's pretty bad. There's some like good people here too, and they're more accountable now than they used to be. I hope. But yeah, as long as they're not a pervert or a creep and they're generally respectful of me and my feelings, and they act professionally, I don't have a style preference at this point.
You don't mind when, because I also met actors who really feel uncomfortable when you let them to, you know, to their own devices. Like they really do like, no, please tell me what you want so that I'll just basically give you that. So it's always really, you really have to adapt.
What do you like to do as a director, Yasser?
Yeah, what do you prefer? Like, what do you think gets the best results for you?
So again, same answer. I'm in the initial stages. That's the neutral response. In all honesty, I think it really depends because if we just take my first film, I had two actors, one who really liked to be direct. Like, honestly, just tell me what you want, what kind of intonation you like, really like to be walked through each line. And the other one who really was like, no, just I got the script, leave me be. If really something is off or something doesn't feel right, just tell it to me. But other than that, leave me be. So every time I'd say cut, it was always weird. It looked like I was really favoring one other than the other. But the other was, he was in his bubble. He didn't want to be disturbed. The
Well,
character and the
you went
father.
into the
Really interesting.
trickiest thing because you had two different totally active
Approaches.
acting style in front of you, and you had to like juggle with them. So that's difficult. But
True.
like I would say, it depends on first of all on your personality and obviously the personality and the character of the other people you work with. But also, I mean, it's like let's say I have to work for 2 days on whatever on a movie or whatever. I'm not the lead role or anything. I would say, what do you want me to do? I would trust you to have like the big picture. I don't perhaps I don't have time to like fully get involved with the script. I'm just going to be there, have you a few lines with your lead and just fuck off, and that's let's not waste time or whatever. But also I do respect the control freaks because I am one. So I would
Yeah, me
yeah
too.
so I would I totally understand that, if you want some actors to be complete tools of what you want to do, like even to the muscle thing that's on your face, etc., if you have a vision. But I talked to a script writer friend, a screenwriter friend who actually also kind of realized that like new ideas could come up with just a discussion with actors, on some
That is so
on
true.
some
That
stuff.
is so true.
So I would say, if you have some scenes in your movie that you just dreamt of and it's going to be like that, I would be the control freak for those scenes. But for the other ones, and if you have time also, because that's the thing. So time is also more budget. So if you have the time to explore
But
things.
to add to. To add to what you're saying, like that's the beauty of directing, though. Like you often hear, like directors also always talk about manipulation, right? Because you're a control freak. For example, the dude who said, "No, leave me to my own devices." He wasn't improvising, and he was going AWOL on me. Like he was doing exactly the intentions and just, giving me the performance that I wanted. It's just that. You're less explicit in your direction. That's all. You're seeing it from afar, but you are guiding him towards what you want, So it's like you're masking it. Whereas the other, verbatim, word for word. So here you do this, then you do that, then you go there, then he says that, then you come back, Whereas the other one, if ever there's, I would often say, "That was great. Could you do it this way now?" Always say, "That's great. That's great. You're doing a great job. How about you do something completely different?" But I love what you did.
Yeah, there's a lot of delicate actors out there for sure, including me. I think I'm a little bit delicate. No, I'm not delicate, but I definitely appreciate the occasional
Yeah,
compliment.
obviously.
Sure. Of
But
course.
there's this theory of, some actors and
Sorry,
actresses
guys.
have to be kind of whoa, what's happening? Is he dead? No.
It's too cold, brother. It's too cold.
No, yeah, there's this theory on the fact that some actors and some actresses kind of have to be so, I don't want to say diva, but almost, because that's their character, that's their inner sensibility that's like this, and that's what allows them to actually reach for things that are great on screen. I mean, I can see that a little bit, although I want to say that if it just get you to have a scene that's 0.2% better, but you're really horrible with the whole set and with all the crew, just relax a little bit. No? Don't you think?
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely.
Have you done any acting yourself?
Yeah, I have, but like it was really like short stuff on a TV show and on like cameos, really.
Nothing
more than that. But I mean,
man, that's already more than I can say. I've only acted in student films, which have never been seen.
that's something.
And to start, yeah, you know,
start.
I think you never know what's gonna turn out to be great. So, but I feel like TV is like the new film in some ways, because I feel like TV credits count for more than film, like with agents and stuff.
As far as job opportunities are concerned, TV is officially the new film for sure.
Yeah.
Everybody's going into TV, man. It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
I mean,
because there's no gigs. Like,
I just realized this podcast actually should have been my movie podcast and not another Le Meilleur. But yeah. Netflix is just like becoming such a thing on the production of thing. I mean, I already see so much stuff from French production that Netflix is allowing here. I have to say, for now, the quality of what they produce is not that great, but at least they're doing it. So I'm always kind of hopeful that, you know, those people will first of all get better at what they're doing, and also will make other people that are to me at least more interesting have the potential production in Netflix.
Yeah. And stand-up is a really great way to branch into like all forms of entertainment, I think. Like there's been some incredible stand-ups who've had just really cool, interesting careers in all kinds of media.
Yeah, definitely. I have to...
Did you repeat the beginning of that sentence? It cut and it sounded so interesting.
Oh, I just said like stand-up is a really great way for people to branch into different types of entertainment and media.
Right. Led you, because I don't want to, this is a big gross generalization, but actors, okay, particularly theater actors, have a strong ego, right? And they do think that they're on top of the world, and they do consider stand-up comedy as a sous art, okay?
As
so
a what?
An underground, a sous art.
Oh.
So it's like a, yeah, you know, like a, ugh, ugh. If you call that theater, I shall not be discussing with you. I, speaking like fucking Shakespeare.
Oh, yeah. I guess especially
so
in England,
what led you to do stand-up? Oh, yeah. The English school is very highbrow.
Yeah. I feel like I've always had kind of, honest, like a multifaceted identity that didn't always make sense together, like both artistically and just as a person. It's a long story, but like I feel like I've always been a part of like communities that sometimes, like artistically or even like from my family, like you know, as an example, I'll do like performance art that's really kind of like dark and artsy. And then I'll do stand-up, and like I feel like there's not a lot of bridge between those two types of people. So I feel like I've always been interested in like trying things from a different way, or like not being closed-minded about like different ways of expressing myself or expressing ideas I have, because I just feel like a really strong existential like thing inside of me. Like there's this thing that I really want to express, and I don't know exactly what that is, but I feel like I'm trying to kind of come at it from different ways, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, I think because
also,
no, go ahead.
I was going to say like strategically, I have the impression again, maybe I'm wrong, but I really do have an impression that the best way to go about it, if you're a young actor who wants to pitch a show to Netflix, it really helps if you're a successful, not even that successful, I mean, a fairly good stand-up, because so many of these new like comedy shows or even dramas, I mean, like comedy drama slash drama shows like Rami for Hulu, you know, the
Yeah,
guy who
he's
got the, you know, Rami
amazing.
Youssef. Like, and I have the impression that so many of these like new comedy shows, the dudes were initially stand-ups. You know, Atlanta, Childish Gambino did stand-up, Rami Youssef did stand-up, the Mindy show, Mindy was a stand-up. You know, like you have so many where if you're a stand-up and you know you have a fairly good name, you have more odds of getting that pitch validated and moving into production with a Netflix or a HBO than if you're just, you know, your typical theater actor. At least that's what I have. Like, I have that
From
impression.
what I understand, they have at least in Hollywood, they have more and usually have meetings with stand-up comedians to pitch them shows like on a regular basis. Because if you're listening to some comedian podcast in LA, they're always talking about like I pitched that show to blah blah blah, and obviously like probably 90% of them never see the light of day, but they do have those meetings though, which is kind of different, I think, here in France. Because I mean, the whole France, I think, has kept a little bit of some aristocracy in some levels of real power, you know, and to be able to have something produced is to already kind of be internalized in some circles, or to have a big following, and which is also what matters, also in Hollywood, by the way, you know, because followings. I mean, you might be extremely funny. Your pitch might be the greatest thing that's ever been known, but you know, if you only have 10K followers on Instagram or whatever, why would they give you money?
True.
Yeah, the social media and like making success for yourself is definitely very real. You know, there's exceptions to every rule, but like it'll definitely give you the extra push to be noticed by the right people, I think.
So speaking about, I think it's a great crossway, and then we'll get back to the intricacies of stand-up
I love how
comedy,
you're taking the
but
reins
success for
of this
yourself
podcast, because
and
for once I have nothing to do. So thank you, Yasser. I'm actually on vacation a little
enjoy
bit.
it, brother. Enjoy it. Enjoy it,
Really.
man. So when you're talking about social media and making a success for yourself, this question is for you, Oreski. When are you going to license this podcast
Yeah. Just when they give me $20 million for it.
Oh, 20 million. I
Just
like your
yeah, I'm
thinking.
just like cutting, dividing by five what they gave to Joe Rogan. I think it's pretty fair, right?
That sounds fair. Yeah, it's
No.
10x your
By
revenue.
the
That's how
way,
it
I'm
works.
totally open for a buyout. I don't care if you know Halliburton or
Get my
Monsanto
IP. Get
or
my
whatever
IP. Just give me
wants.
the 20 mil.
I'm open to any sponsorship of, I don't know, of anything. Really great. I will sell guns if you want to have money for that. I'm a total sellout, but from the now, I'm just not going to sell it because no one's
Isn't
offering.
that crazy though? Like if you actually sit down and think about it, 100 million for 3 year licensing to go to
Yeah.
Spotify. This is a dude who basically sits down and just talks, enjoys life. What it, like I have the impression that this is a statement where basically the internet is winning. That's all it's saying, and that content is officially king, you know?
What do you want to say about that, Sophia? I mean, you have do you listen to podcasts usually, by the way? Are you a podcast? Not really.
Not as much as I should. I like assist on a podcast here that like interviews a bunch of actors. But I don't listen to as many as I should. But yeah, I think it makes sense from like a capitalistic perspective. If you have people kind of making their own content for not very much money, like in their apartment, like as an advertiser, it makes sense that you would be interested in that. Like, I guess you get more reward. I don't know, but it's a little sad. I mean, I'm like old world in some ways. Like, I love the theater. I love like old school cinema. So I like to have both, you know.
Andrew Schultz said something really interesting. He said that essentially podcasts are like our Britannica encyclopedia, which is actually true to a certain extent, because every once in a while I've noticed when I'm, you know, when there's a new event or something that comes down, besides reading three or four articles from, you know, various journals, I'll check, you know, the comedian who or person who I know I'm more or less and, you know, have the same like political thinking, and I'll just watch his podcast 5-minute view on, you know, what does Joe Rogan and I don't know Elon Musk think about, you know, the George Floyd, you know, murder.
Yeah,
it's like, oh, okay, so that's what happened, that's the lowdown. But I'm like, what he said is essentially that's how young people are getting their, I mean, of course, gross generality again, but that's a way that a lot of people are just getting their info, is just through podcasts. That's how they're learning about science, with, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson being invited at Joe Rogan. That's how they're learning about, you know, the developments of tech with Elon Musk, and comedy through Andrew Schultz and whatnot. I don't know. This is why it's like, it's really interesting, this entire situation. And basically Spotify just stamped that, yes, this is the future with that deal.
Well, I mean, he was the future. He was the present, because of the 100 million of downloads he had, like, every month. But you have to rewind a little bit. You have to like know why. I mean, just in the US for now, let's talk why podcasts have been like a huge success. There has been a lot of first, perhaps distrust of the media. I think earlier than what we have here in Europe. I think in the US, and also some kind of too much vanilla fiction production, even in comedy, etc., on TV, etc., and censorship of sponsorship, which cannot exist when you're in your garage and you're just waiting for no money. So now you're doing this, and now people kind of see, oh, it actually attracts people. They have a following now that we are not here as executive producer giving you notes on bullshit, because we cannot sell as much yogurt or whatever. And now so it's kind of a counter power to the mainstream media, which which doesn't exist here in France, because the podcast has been pretty much like bought and eaten by the radios here. Yeah. That didn't exist. So because they saw it was working well in the US, so they had to move on it. And there's literally no podcast I can think of with people here just actually talking about what they think. It's here, it's always like journalists.
Yeah, but do you know why?
Journalists.
Do you know why? Because in France, people don't. Sorry, I cut you. No, like, because in France, people don't like giving their opinions. It's like, you know, they're scared to give the opinion because they don't want to look like idiots. Here we are, us three, completely decomplex, just saying stuff. Whereas in France, it'd be like, oh, no, wait, are you saying a lot of people are going to watch this? No. Let's talk about Jean-Paul Sartre. We need to talk about Paul Sartre.
That's why, by the way, I mean, it works also a little bit in the US, because it's always harder to give your opinion. That's why it's always comedians that had the best podcasts and at least the most listened to, because, you know, comedians, when you're on stage, if you're not here to say what you think, what the fuck are you here to say? You know, oranges
Yeah.
are orange. All right, great. Next one. Fuck you. And so that's the first class of people that are more decomplexed to just, you know, why? Let me tell you what I think about that thing or that president, et cetera. But here, even here now, like, there's not a lot, first of all, of a comedian podcast here in France. I mean, I literally listen to probably 10 different podcasts on a regular basis of American comedians, and they're pretty much all the same. You know, they're talking alone, or they have like a guest, and they're talking with them, and it's entertaining because those people are funny, and also they have ideas on things, and they have they know what they think, or even if they can change their minds on stuff, it's refreshing just to know and to hear someone who's actually creating an opinion instead of just following something that's already known in the media. And the fact that here it's more, the podcasts are more like journalists that are trying
Exactly,
to,
yeah.
Journalists.
yeah, trying to awaken in the sense of getting people woke on social matters
Yes.
in France, which is great. Don't get me wrong, because you know, that's thing I had that conversation yesterday with other comedians. It's like, for example, on the English scene here in Paris, I can do jokes about systemic racism because everyone knows what it is. I can do jokes about like the social justice warrior thing because everyone know what it is. Here in French, you actually have to first educate the people and then do your joke.
Oh my God.
Just because the base is not known. So I understand why they do that, because podcast again, if you're home and you just have to have like a webcam and a mic, it's always going to be kind of the counter power because you don't have the money to be in a great media. But it's not that interesting if you already know what the fuck they're talking about. That's the thing.
Yeah, that's interesting. I feel like I have seen a lot of like French people like these days saying like, oh, look how racist America is and like how fucked up their history is. And I was like, their colonization was a thing that like France did, but like it's not like, you know, there's different separate problems, and it's not like, I don't know, it's just weird that like I think there's a tendency for people to be like, oh, this is like something that's happening in a different place, you know.
That's true.
But
That's true. Actually, like Carter had made on your podcast.
anyway.
So here you go, me doing an ad for another
Thank
episode.
you.
So the Carter Morgan episode, he did make a comment about like the cultural shock that he had experienced going into that clown
Oh,
school,
yeah,
where
right.
essentially,
True.
like when they were
Who
doing
was
certain
that?
sketches, so Carter Morgan, he was another fellow
Oh,
comedian
yeah.
whom we love and we say hello
Yeah.
to, who's currently in New York. He was talking about how when he was in clown school, so essentially
Paris.
they had these exercises where they had to go and write sketches, and a lot of them came back and they did, you know, the blackface, and they were just making just, you know, these jokes that just Carter was sitting there going, wait a second, that's, you know, that's racist, right? And they were just completely oblivious, and they were saying, I don't understand, you know, and not just the blackface. I mean, there were heaps apparently of racist jokes, and Carter just, he was. You know, he basically educated a whole cohort. By the end of the year, he just had enough. But I mean, you know, bless podcasts because they have made washing the dishes so much fun.
Yeah, totally.
You know
I
what I
mean,
think is lacking here in France? This is weird, but really, I do think I'm almost inclined to do this myself. It's kind of have an Alex Jones podcast here. I want to have some kind of extreme right-wing podcast here to put the kind of the boundaries of the podcast to be able to say, okay, you actually can have a podcast that's talking about Hillary Clinton eating babies or whatever the fuck he's saying.
Yeah.
Because here it's so clean. It's a podcast. I think here it's pretty much on like 30-ish people that are militant, are left-wing, and I am, by the way, but that are about or did have like a baby. So it's all about like giving a voice to new parents and blah blah blah, and just and all of those things. And it's like, yeah, but where's the fun? Where do I have people that are completely gone wild,
edgy?
Yeah,
you should start. You know what? You should do like two different, like, you should have two different like personas, and you could like wear like a hat and a mustache for one of them. And like they're enemies of each other.
Yes, yeah. But that's the thing that I do have, and we all have. You talked about this earlier. I mean, you do have like multiple facets, you know, of your personality. Like you have sides, and that's the whole thing. Sometimes I just think completely bonkers stuff, and I answer myself because I'm a nuanced person. But to be a nuanced person, you kind of have those two sides. But nuance has never created a following. No one is for a political guy who's going to say, it's more complicated than that. Let me explain. And you know, perhaps Bill Nye, the science guy, if he actually wanted to, to run for Congress or whatever. But you always want to listen to people that are totally one thing, because the human mind, I guess, is like this. But I don't know.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question? Speaking about left wing, so the people are demanding, Oreski, that you give us a walkthrough of your library. I have fucking been meaning to ask you that since the dawn of time, my friend.
Of my library.
Have to get going in just a few minutes.
Oh, no worries.
Sorry.
Let's end up on that then.
I don't know.
You'll, you'll tell me.
But yeah, it's a to be continued of suspense with the comics. I would love to see the library sometime.
Yeah, definitely. We'll do that. And you'll tell me which book you wanna borrow from me.
Yeah, definitely. Anyway. And if you guys want to continue, like, don't mind.
No, don't worry. I have literally nothing
you
to say to
the
answer.
I know. Well, I love talking to both of you. I love
that. No, but thank you.
I love getting to know you, and I hope I wasn't.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much to you too. And you know what? We'll do that more often. Thank you very much.
I would love to do it again. Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Sophia.
Bye. Enjoy the funeral. Oh, yeah.